associate book burning with terrible people, totalitarian dictators in general and Nazis in particular. So how is it that in the United States, book banning often takes place at the behest of those who insist they have benevolent, even protective intentions, like parent groups and the school boards they elect? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. On the other side of this equation are community members who worry that censoring literature for its controversial ideas can be a slippery slope toward a culture that makes space only for very limited ideas. Kate Cohen is a contributing columnist at The Washington Post, a writer and voracious reader who does not support the kind of book banning efforts currently happening in states like Oklahoma, Tennessee, and Texas. Despite her concerns about this, though, she's found a certain kind of silver lining inherent in the desire to keep certain works out of school curricula and libraries. They are proof, she says, that books still matter a lot. Cohen's recent columns include the one titled The Furor Over Inappropriate Books in Schools is Frightening, but There's a Thrilling Subtext. Kate, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Why is this happening?
I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. Why is this happening now, do you think? This spate of book banning.
Well, first of all, I would say that it happens at regular intervals, and this is a kind of a recent bubbling up. I think the thing that made me start to think about it in particular was the issue with Virginia, where Terry McAuliffe was debating Glenn Youngkin and was talking about the fact that he didn't think parents should be determining what their children were learning in school. That was the first time I started thinking about this issue. And I only bring that up because one of the scary books that was mentioned in that debate was Beloved by Toni Morrison. And that actual complaint happened in 2013. So, you know, everything old is new again. why now? I mean, my guess would be that people are feeling the world changing around them, and they're trying to control the part that they feel that they can control, which is their children's school and their school districts and what their children read and consume.
So
that's my guess.
What kind of subject matter tends to get books banned or objected to for use by students?
Right now, you're sort of seeing two distinct strains. One is books having to do with race and racial justice. Like the 1619 Project, that New York Times project that was then turned into a book, that's come under a lot of criticism, and there's bills and now even laws specifically telling teachers they can't teach that. And so there's a lot of books, if you look at lists of proposed banned books or banished books, which is my preferred term, because I feel like not all of these actions are about actually banning books so much as taking them out of the curriculum. But if you look at these lists, there's a lot of books that have to do with racism, social justice. What does it mean to be a white person? What does it mean to be a Black person? How you can be a better friend to Black people? How, as a Black person, you can navigate the racism that we still see around us. So there's that angle. And then I think probably I wrote more about the area of sexuality, gender, sexual orientation. There's that whole angle, which, you know, concerned parents will call obscene or pornographic, and I might see more as informative. So those are the two, those to me are the two main strains of concern. And they both come down to, again, wanting, I guess, your children to see the world exactly the way you saw it when you went to school however many years ago. And I don't think that's a very productive way to go at it.
It's interesting too, because it's pretty, I mean, parents with any any experience under their belts know that it's pretty much impossible to make your kids see the world exactly as you see it, regardless of what they read.
It's a real losing game. As a parent, I want to win the game. So I don't quite understand it either. The sort of approach of I'm going to keep my kids in a bubble, not let them even hear about things I disagree with, or be exposed to ways other people might live, or even concepts that could be upsetting or make you angry, any of these things. And then I don't know what the end point is. Then they get married and they go off on their own and they have to deal with it however they do. I don't know. For me, as a parent, and I wrote this piece, well, partly as a person looking back on my own experience as a reader, but also as a parent. For me as a parent, I feel like my job is to help my child take in information about the world, anything that's challenging or confusing or upsetting that they may hear about or that they may feel, and help them work through it. That's my job, not to sort of keep them from experiencing things or pretend that they're not experiencing things that they may well be. So I guess it's a different approach. Well, I guess there may be a sort of a cynical political aspect of it, but to the extent that it is genuine, these concerns, it's just a very different approach to the idea of what it means to raise a child.
Okay, let's talk about this book that got people spun up in McMinn County, Tennessee. This is a graphic memoir called Mouse by Art Spiegelman. What is it about?
Mouse is about the sort of main character discusses or finds out about his father's experience during the Holocaust. His father, it's been years since I've read it, but it was for me, and it came out, I think, when I was right at the right age, in the maybe in 1980. I'd have to look it up, but it's a graphic memoir, but it's also a fairly graphic representation of what happened during the Holocaust. And it really was for me, and I'm Jewish, and so I obviously had some concept. I shouldn't say obviously, but I did have some concept of what the Holocaust was. But to sort of experience it viscerally through those pages was a big moment for me. So the debate as that I talked about really didn't have anything to do with oh, maybe kids are too young to see how horrible one set of human beings can be to another set of human beings, or maybe just the Holocaust in general isn't something we should be teaching at that age, which would be problematic in itself. It was really about the few curse words that were in the novel, and I believe the depiction of a naked woman. The mother in the story kills herself, and you see her naked body in the bathtub. But she's also depicted as a mouse, so it's not. It's not. I don't know.
It's not
It's
graphic human nudity in the,
not graphic human nudity, and even if it were graphic human nudity, it's not in the purpose of you know, for the purpose of anything other than talking about the horror that was this experience. So that it was a shocking moment, certainly, that they decided to remove it from the curriculum. I do want to say that as I was writing this piece, I found a lot of headlines about how Maus had been banned or banned from the school or any of those things. And what it was removed as the sort of center point of the, I think, eighth grade curriculum, which is different. And I'm not saying that's not a problem. I'm just saying I like to be very careful about saying what actually happened or didn't happen. You can still read Maus and in McMinn County, Tennessee, you can still read Maus. You could probably still get it out of the school library. It wasn't about that. It was whether or not they were going to focus the curriculum on that.
Kate, what is fascinating, I think, about parents and school board administrators who want to protect children from these ideas is that, like, it's one thing to take kids away from content they object to in the form of a book. But in the case of Art Spiegelman's Maus, you know, these were eighth graders assigned to read this book. Mm-hmm. I have to assume most of these kids had almost unfettered access to the internet, which is full of objectionable ideas and good ideas and all kinds of ideas.
I know. It's really amazing. I don't, you know, at first I sort of thought, well, this is just, it just shows how, I don't know, behind the times these people are, that they think one nude mouse lady in a book is really going to just shock their kids, or the word damn, which apparently was an issue.
By the way, you're even allowed to say that on the radio, so that's
I know. Yeah. So at first I thought, oh, they're just behind, and this is so old-fashioned, how quaint. But I do think that they have a point in the sense that that books as objects and as ways to convey knowledge are uniquely powerful. Although I absolutely don't think they should be banned or limited or anything like that, I recognize how powerful they were in my life and still are. You know, they are sort of a way to access information that is so intimate and is so personal to the person, to the reader, in a way that I think kind of the video content that you can access isn't. You know, you really have to collaborate with a writer when you're reading a book. You have to imagine what they're trying to get you to imagine. It's not an assault in the way that sort of visual kinds of information can be an assault. And so that creates a unique relationship between the person and the information. And it also, to me, makes books indispensable as a way of kind of approaching the world right at the point that you are ready to approach it. Yeah, I found it sort of incredible that we're still talking about books being the thing that it corrupts children. But I kind of dig it too as a writer.
Well, the other reality is that, you know, teachers of literature are not assigning these books in the curriculum in quite the same way that the textbook for, you know, biology or history
right.
might be assigned as, you know, handed to children who are told everything in this book is true and you should learn and believe it. Now, I know that
right.
those books can also be debated. That's a topic for another show. But, I mean, teachers, the whole point of having kids read these books is to have these critical discussions about them afterward.
Yes, I think that's true. And I think maybe the people who are afraid of them or think that their children should be protected from them don't really understand what reading is or don't really understand what a critical reader does. And of course, you're right, a good teacher is asking children to interact with what they're reading, to disagree with what they're reading, to express their emotions about what they're reading, all of those things. And a good parent could do that too, theoretically. And I feel like my solution for a lot of these parents would be read the book. Read the book. If you're worried about your kid reading something that you think might be troubling, read the book and talk about the book with your child. And tell them what you think. If you complete, if it contains values that you think are abhorrent, you would think that that would be a teaching moment for parents. But yes, they're not just, it's not like instruction manuals or textbooks exactly, these books.
I don't know what your politics are, but we tend to associate book banning efforts in this country with folks who are on the far end of the political right. Certainly, there are books, including famous works of literature, that might feel really objectionable to folks on the political left. Do we all need to sort of, wherever we fall on that spectrum, do we need to put ourselves through the exercise of imagining a book that we actually found problematic was assigned to our kids, as we consider how to deal with these questions?
Absolutely. And I really try to think about this and do that kind of thought experiment because I do tend to be much, I'm very progressive. I want my kids to read books that have a wide range of perspectives and identities and everything. I want them to come home from school and teach me stuff that I don't know. But is it conceivable that they would be taught a book that I objected to and therefore demanded that it was removed from schools? I don't know. I have to think about that. Certainly, as a kid, I was taught things that were objectionable. I was taught that the Civil War was about states' rights. My sex ed class was completely useless. All those things. And I and even my children came home from their sex ed class and told me things that I thought were absolutely ridiculous. And I told them so, and we had a good conversation about it. So it's not like I feel this way because, generally the world is going in my direction. I don't think that that is true. I think that sure, there could be a book that I found objectionable, and I would talk to my kids about why.
Okay, the other thing that occurs to me is that we both underestimate the intelligence of children and we overestimate, in some ways, the power of books. Like, if every young white kid assigned to read Beloved or To Kill a Mockingbird seriously was able to recognize the evils of racism and change their hearts and their minds, we would have solved a lot of problems in this country. We're not there yet.
That's an excellent point. I do think, well, I do think we underestimate our children. That's for sure. And it's funny because, of course, we all were 16 years old. So it's funny that to look back and think, oh no, my 16-year-old is pure and she never thinks about sex and she would be shocked to learn I don't know that there are gays and lesbians in the world or something like that. It's just funny because we all had internal lives at that point. My daughter is a junior in high school, and she recently read a book that she said was the most amazing book that she'd ever read. It's a book of short stories by Carmen Maria Machado called Her Body and Other Parties. And what she told me, and it was for a creative writing class, and she told me that she loved it, and it sort of changed her concept of writing, but also how moved she was that her teachers trusted her with this book, which is very sexually explicit and kind of weird. And I read it and I was like, whoa. But I wasn't like, whoa, she shouldn't read this. It was more like, whoa, I didn't realize that she was this old, or that she was this complicated, or that she was this ready to think about issues of sex and misogyny, or all the abuse, all the things that were present in these stories that are upsetting. The kids are dealing with upsetting things, from the moment they lose a pet, or from the moment their parents fight. So to kind of pretend that they're not is does them a disservice, I think. And it's much better to sort of recognize that they are. As for the power of the written word to change people's minds, I'm working on that. Maybe it's a slow process. Obviously, it's a slow process. I think it's fascinating that I would have thought at the sort of beginning of the internet era that the fact that everybody had all the information available to them at all times would kind of solve everything. I mean, to your point, right? It would sort of be like, oh, other people have different perspectives, or maybe mine isn't the only religion, or all of those things, because you would be able to sort of see. But it hasn't happened that way, and I think that's very interesting. Maybe the next column. It almost feels like it almost feels like instead of kids in New York and kids in Texas and Oklahoma, basically all, now that we all share the same information, would basically be learning the same things or raised with the same curriculums, that would have come about by now. But instead, it feels almost more, I don't know, more sort of provincial, or divided according to politics and place.
I've sometimes wondered when the uproar is over a book about race or racism that makes that white parents object to. They will say, well, this makes my child uncomfortable, makes my child feel bad about their race. Sometimes I wonder if what's really happening, and I'm not around everybody's kitchen table, but what's really happening is some of this intergenerational learning you were talking about. These kids are coming home and saying, Mom and Dad, the way we've talked about this is maybe not accurate. And the parents are furious that the kids have a different perspective on race than they do.
I think that's absolutely true, and people are getting defensive about their own, if not place in history, then at least their own blind spots. And it's hard to acknowledge that you were wrong, or even let's say you're completely blameless, except in that you did not sort of adequately account for the ways in which your country needs to change, but so it's hard to either acknowledge that you were wrong or acknowledge that your children have a different perspective. I don't I've been in that situation where I have felt accused, or suddenly like not I think of myself as very progressive, and then all of a sudden, wait, I'm not the most progressive person at this kitchen table. What happened? So yeah, I think the discomfort, if not, I agree with you that the discomfort isn't necessarily so much the child's discomfort as it is the parent's discomfort. But again, that is no reason. Discomfort in and of itself, I believe, is kind of a wonderful thing. It's really what wakes you up in the middle of your, day that was just like every other day, and it makes you think about things. It's very easy to go through life and not. And so, being made uncomfortable by new ideas is, wow, it's one of the blessings of being a human being. So it's just hard to embrace. In the moment, it's hard to embrace. It's funny though, because I think for a while it was progressives who were getting critiqued or criticized for being overly sensitive or trying to make an overly sensitive educational environment for children, and providing trigger warnings for everything. Do you remember that
Sure.
period? And thinking about it now, it's just so clear what a trigger warning is. A trigger warning is, look, I am going to talk about this thing. It's not a refusal to talk about something that's difficult or challenging. It's just a heads up. This is what's going to happen. So in a funny way, it actually allows for far more discussion, and far more, varieties of information and learning than just taking the books out of the library and switching the curriculum would. So maybe the conservatives need trigger warnings. That'll solve the problem. We'll just say, fair warning. We're about to acknowledge the fact that there are, gay and lesbians in the world, that there are, non-traditional families, et cetera. And that racism hasn't been solved yet. That's what we need, trigger warnings.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I know you're being a little bit facetious there, Kate, but in all
Yeah, sorry.
seriousness, in the minute or so we have left, is there a way to strip the politics out of these conversations to acknowledge some of these things are hard for parents to countenance, and maybe they could get there if we could just sit down and have a rational conversation?
I think that's difficult. I try to write really from the perspective of either a person living in the world or a parent trying to parent. And I, as we touched on earlier, I'm really convinced that my job as a parent is to help my child navigate the world, not keep the world away from my child, not keep ideas I don't agree with away from my child, or books, out of my child's hands or anything like that. But try to look at things from my child's perspective and help them through it. So I think if parents could do that and actually read the books that their kids are bringing home that they're concerned about, that might help. That
Kate
might help.
Cohen is a contributing columnist at the Washington Post, whose recent columns include the one titled "The Furor Over Inappropriate Books in Schools is Frightening, but There's a Thrilling Subtext." Kate, thanks very much for making time for us.
Thank you.
You can subscribe to our podcast where you get podcasts by searching for KERA Think or listen anytime at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.